Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. After Nevada rejected it, some want Utah to take on the nation's nuclear waste. Representative Burgess Owens will not seek re-election to Congress this fall. A man accused in Wayne County killings faces aggravated murder charges. And UDOT wants to build a highway through generations-old agricultural land. Farmers and activists are pushing back. Joining me today are Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Leah, thank you.
Good morning, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Also joining us, politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thank you.
Hey, good morning, Tom.
Good morning. And later in the program, we'll hear from reporter Sam Moylan. Let's start with Leah Larson. Interesting story. Here's the headline again. After Nevada rejected it, some want Utah to take on the nation's nuclear waste. We're talking about Millard County in this case, salt caverns.
Yes. Yeah. And all credit goes to Matt Ward with the Millard County Chronicle Progress, because working his network of sources down there in Millard County, he obtained this email that was kind of the focus of this story. But to kind of lay the background for your listeners, our Governor Spencer Cox has, of course, really honed in on energy for his second term through this Operation Gigawatt, where he wants to more than double Utah's energy generation in the next decade. I think he sees a writing on the wall with the rise of artificial intelligence. And, you know, all projections say that we're going to be moving toward electric vehicles instead of gas-powered vehicles. And our grid and our power system is just not equipped to handle that. So his Operation Gigawatt is supposed to be an all-of-the-above strategy is what he calls it, but he really has honed in on nuclear. That's what you hear a lot of his initiatives, a lot of the discussion about. In fact, I think he had an op-ed just this morning in Power Magazine with the governor of Hawaii talking about how the nation kind of needs to rebuild its energy backbone, which sounds painful, but we have done it as a nation before, so it's not unprecedented. But I think with the focus on nuclear, the question on everybody's mind is, what are we going to do with all the waste? You know, this waste lasts for thousands of years. It's very dangerous. It's radioactive, can cause cancer. Many people in Utah are well aware of this. We have this legacy of downwinders from nuclear testing many decades ago. So back in the 80s, when everyone thought nuclear was going to power everything, Congress decided that Yucca Mountain in Nevada was going to be the nation's repository to store all this nuclear waste and also nuclear weapons waste. But Nevadans did not like this being foisted on them. They fought back pretty aggressively. So that's been on pause. So I've been wondering, and I think a lot of Utahns have been wondering, if Utah's really embracing this new nuclear revolution we're apparently experiencing right now, what's going to happen to all the waste? Currently, most labs and power plants use nuclear energy. They're just storing the waste on site, and that's not a very good feeling solution. It doesn't feel very permanent. People feel better knowing it's going to have a place to go eventually. And apparently, I guess, Utah wants to be part of that solution. So that is where we find ourselves today.
And specifically, Senator Darren Owens, Republican from Fountain Green, I guess, is Millard County in his district?
Yeah. So he's a senator. Fountain Green is what, Sam Pete County?
Sam Pete County.
With these more rural central Utah districts, you know, they kind of will include many counties and communities. But yes, he does represent kind of that area.
So he's saying, well, we got the salt dome out there, and that might be a place that we could store this this waste. Also, he's talking about recycling. We'll get into that a little bit later. But so I guess this would be a time for you to explain the salt dome to us.
Yeah, let me do my best as neither a geologist nor an engineer. These salt domes, energy people, energy engineers have been looking at them for a long time. We are currently using them, I think, to store fuels. The Intermountain Power Plant down there in Delta has begun storing hydrogen generated from renewables in these caverns. It kind of acts as a battery. So when the sun goes down or the wind stops blowing, they can pull in the hydrogen to keep powering all the things we use, keep the grid alive. A lot of people are eyeing these and coming up with creative ways of using them, and I guess they're attractive for storing nuclear waste. And I guess to give your listeners even more background, where do these salt dumps come from? My understanding is they're remnants of ancient shallow seas that used to cover Utah around the time of the dinosaurs. And then when all the water evaporated, it left all the salt behind and came buried deep beneath the earth. So yes, central Utah is replete with these kind of formations. And the way they made the caverns, from what I understand, is the kind of, the caverns aren't already there. They have to inject them with water, and the water will dissolve away the salts, and then you'll have like this contained cave within them.
So, right now being used for other hydrogen and other things, could nuclear waste be safely transported and put in these caverns?
Great question. I don't know. I don't think any of us really know for sure. Nuclear waste has been stored in old salt mines in the past. New Mexico currently stores radioactive waste in some salt caverns. And in Germany, from what I've read, around World War II, the Germans stuck a bunch of their nuclear waste into an old salt mine, which is currently leaking. Not to scare people, but I think that just goes to show you there's kind of varying degrees of success in using this. But yeah, it is kind of new and hasn't been done in a whole lot of places, but definitely a creative idea.
Before we get into recycling and et cetera, and the Department of Energy's plan for the what they call these hubs, I'd like to have you tell me about what locals think. What do people in Millard County think about this?
That's a better question for Matt, since Matt is the boots on the ground who lives in Millard County. But what his reporting showed is that it seems to be at least a little bit mixed. There's at least one county commissioner down there who's embracing this as another form of economic development for this area. And to be fair, Millard County has had its fair share of hardship. The coal mining community has really downsized. People aren't really turning to coal for energy as much as they were even a decade ago. They had a pork processing plant down there that shut down. So they're really grasping for ways to, keep their kids from leaving the county, to create jobs, to create economic opportunity. It's, a very beautiful part of the state, but very rural. And so some of their opportunities are limited. But they do have a lot of experience with energy. And like I mentioned, Intermountain Power Plants down there, which is a huge coal plant that just a big part of it just converted to natural gas plant. And they're doing the hydrogen and the salt caverns. So they have experience with this. So this could be great on the one hand for economic development. On the other hand, there are county commissioners and other elected leaders, residents down there who just, like a lot of people, just are uneasy with the idea of radioactive waste being stored in their backyards, essentially, for generations and generations and generations. It gives a lot of people an uneasy feeling. I think that's why Nevada pushed back so hard when Congress kind of tried to foist Yucca Mountain on them.
Department of Energy, I think it is, they're soliciting states to host what they call nuclear life cycle innovation campuses.
Quite a mouthful.
That sounds great.
Sounds great.
It's a campus, but what would this be?
I think just based on the news release that the department put out, could be all kinds of things. It could be a place where you store radioactive waste. It could be a place where you're experimenting with it. It could be a place where you're building advanced reactors. But I think the key word in that kind of long jargony descriptor is life cycle. So we want to go from refining radioactive material to turn it into a fuel, to burning the fuel, to recycling the fuel, which you've alluded to a couple of times. And that there, I guess, is this the life cycle of nuclear. So that's what they're pushing for. And I think maybe, the feds have learned from their past mistakes in that when you force a community to take this stuff, you will get blowback. So now what they're trying to do, it seems, is ask communities to invite these kinds of things in. And that takes us, I suppose, to Representative, or sorry, Senator Darren Owens' email from January, when the Department of Energy, when they made this announcement that they were asking for states to come forward and, put their hat in the ring, I guess, to host these nuclear life cycle campus. The same day, he sent an email to a bunch of his colleagues in the legislature, to some people in Millard County, and some lobbyists, saying like, "This is Utah's once in a lifetime opportunity. Let's meet the moment. This is our time to shine. So let's aggressively pursue this." And that's where our story came from.
We should know, as you do in the story, there's only one other state that seems potentially interested.
Well, I don't know about that. In Senator Owen's email, he alluded to the fact that Mississippi also has these salt dome formations that Utah has, and alluded to the fact that maybe Mississippi was very interested in hosting one of these nuclear life cycle. I keep wanting to say lifestyle campuses, but not lifestyle, life cycle campuses. So I haven't confirmed that independently. That's just, drawing from his email. But I don't know which states have applied. That information hasn't been released yet. I even tried to see if Utah had actually applied by submitting a records request, and that was declined, not because the records don't exist, interestingly, but because they deal with sensitive negotiations over real estate. But yes, it seems that based on the senator's email, at least Mississippi is considering this. But Senator Owen said, Utah has the same salt formation, and we could quote, "Let's lead the West," is what he said. Let's lead the West.
So these are life cycle campuses. So tell me about Curio Energy. This is a company that has a patent for a process. They say they can take this spent fuel and recycle it.
Right. So Curio was mentioned in Senator Owen's email, which is why they sparked our interest. And you're right. So this was a company that was founded in 2021, I believe, by two brothers. It's based in Washington, D.C. And they have developed this kind of innovative way to recycle nuclear material. It hasn't been used commercially. It's just kind of been done in the labs and like pilots and things. And they brought on this guy, Ed McGuinness, who worked for the Department of Energy for decades and decades. So he's now the CEO. So, that's kind of some good clout to have behind you, I guess, if you're trying to get contracts from the Department of Energy. It's nice to have a face that they all recognize. But yes, so their big focus is that they are a recycling company. I think they would also say they are a nuclear life cycle company, because they want to develop advanced reactors, but they also like really gone in on the recycling component. And to their point, there is a lot of valuable material in nuclear fuel. When you burn it in a reactor for 5 years, I think you only use like 10% of what's actually in it. But the thing, like, historically, it's just been so cheap to like mine more uranium and refine it and just keep burning it, that there was really no incentive to recycle the waste. So that's why, we want to bury it in Yucca Mountain, or stick it in a storage warehouse behind a nuclear plant, I guess, because it's just cheaper to keep refining more and more fuel. But I guess they think they can make a profit off of this recycling material. They can pull critical minerals out of it. They could use some isotopes for cancer treatments and other medical uses. So that seems to be their focus. And I think their other push is that it makes it more palatable for communities who are hosting these campuses, because instead of a power plant that's generating radioactive waste, it's going to take thousands of years to decompose. It only takes hundreds of years, which still feels like a long time, but maybe that's a little easier to digest for some communities.
I had a couple of questions reading the story. I don't know if we have answers to this. Would a company like Curio use all of that waste and recycling, or part of it, and some of it's left?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a fair question. They will still produce waste just based on public statements they've made, but like I said, it would only be radioactive for hundreds of years instead of thousands of years. So I don't think there's a way to fully recycle and reuse everything and make it completely inert, right? But there will still be a waste product that needs to go somewhere.
Yeah, and therefore that's why you would need the salt dome in this case.
Yes,
Yeah.
exactly.
All right. Anything else you'd like to say about this story?
I don't know. if any of your listeners have any tips or insights, there's so many people who are so smart on this nuclear topic out there, and I love hearing from them. So please feel free to reach out and talk to me about it.
Yeah. Oh, one more question. Of course, Representative Owens is excited about this. What about state leaders? Has governor talked about this? Are they on board? What are they saying?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think, like I said at the top, Governor Cox has really honed in on nuclear, so he seems to be very supportive of this industry, which, is worth mentioning. It's the most expensive way to generate energy currently, and it's not like a solve all because it will take at least a decade to even get reactors online. But yes, in the senator's email that Matt Ward obtained a copy of, he did say he called on all his fellow lawmakers and lobbyists on this email to put pressure on the governor's office and get him to like throw in Utah support to become one of these life cycle campuses. And the next day, I don't know if this is a coincidence, but it would be quite the coincidence. The next day, Cox was at the top of this story in E&E News saying like that Utah is exploring this. And it wasn't a yes, but it definitely wasn't a no. So we'll see.
All right. Water and Land Use reporter Leah Larson telling us about this important story. Leah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I know we need to let you go, so thank you for being on with us.
Yeah, take care.
You bet. So you're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. And following a break, we'll be talking with politics reporter Robert Gerke, several stories, including the retirement of Representative Burgess Owens. We'll have more following this. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. And we turn next to politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks so much.
Yeah, happy to be here.
So, several stories I want to talk about the last day of the Utah legislature. But first, Congress. Of course, a new map, new congressional map, and we wondered would a couple of Republicans run against each other? Looks like that's probably not going to happen. Representative Owens says he will not run for another term.
Yeah, I think you set that up well because the new congressional map sort of sets the stage for this whole decision. As we've talked about before, the judge ordered a new map that created and the new map she chose was one that created this Democratic-leaning district in Salt Lake County. That would have been the natural district for Representative Owens to run in if he wanted to run in a Democratic district, or he could have run against one of his Republican colleagues. And so there were questions swirling around about how that game of musical chairs was going to work out. As it so happens, Representative Owens is going to step aside. He's, in his late 70s now, and not run for another term. That kind of sets it up so Blake Moore can run in that northern Utah district, Celeste Molloy in sort of the southern Utah district, and Michael Kennedy in that central Utah district. So Representative Owens calling it quits. I guess, as I put it in the story, in this game of musical chairs, he ended up without a seat. And is going to hang it up after this session, after this Congress.
What did he say in explaining his decision?
Yeah, he said he got into politics because he wanted to help at-risk kids, and he felt like he had done that. He said that as he was thinking about his next stage, that he thought it would be better if he did that outside of the political environment, and so he's going and so he used that as sort of his justification for announcing his retirement. He, said he was proud to be, part of the Trump team and advance the fight against Marxists, as he put it. He's 3-term congressman. He's elected in 2020, reelected in 2022, 24, and going to be stepping aside at the end of this year.
Former NFL player. I don't know much, a
Yeah.
lot else from about him.
Well, it is kind of the thing that I think made him, sort of unique. Well, that and that he was only the second black member of Congress elected from Utah. But he played for University of Miami, was drafted in the NFL, played, I think it was like 13 seasons there, won a Super Bowl ring with the Los Angeles Raiders in 1980, and kind of had a series of business ventures after that. It was part of a lawsuit against the NFL over its concussion, over concussions that players sustained during their playing days, and then got into politics. He announced his candidacy in 2019, and ran against Ben McAdams in that first race. Remember, Ben McAdams was the elected in 2018, the same year that the Better Boundaries and the other initiatives passed. So there was a big influx of more progressive voters that I think helped Ben in 2018. 2020, that was a really close race. The decision wasn't known for several days, but Representative Owens ended up winning that. I believe it was by about 3,000 votes, something like that. So you had the potential, I guess, since Representative McAdams is running again in that first district, the new first district in Salt Lake County. You had a potential for a rematch, but I think given the makeup of that district, that was probably not very attractive for Representative Owens. And plus, you know, like you said, he had things outside of politics that he want is aiming to do after his retirement.
Yeah, I guess we'll see what he does. So a couple of quick hits here, Robert, before we get to a couple of other stories. First, they're calling it gas station heroin. It's kratom, right? So that bill passed the legislature. We've talked extensively about that on this program before, but briefly, what would this bill do?
So kratom is this plant extract that from a plant out of Southeast Asia, and it can provide some stimulant effects. It works on opioid receptors, so it's been used by people who are trying to get off, you know, opioids. But you know, it can be addictive, and you know, you build up a sense a resistance to it, not a sensitivity to it. You build up a resistance to it, and you kind of need more and more and more. There are companies that now make concentrates that can be sold in gas stations and vape shops and things like that. And we've had over 200 deaths since 2015, since 2018, sorry, in Utah that were, now they had other substances in their system. I guess I should be clear about that, but it can cause death because it works in conjunction with some other substances sometimes. And so Senator Mike McKell, Senator Evan Vickers, Representative Jennifer Daley Provo, all had bills this session to regulate, restrict that, particularly the concentrates. Senator McKell's bill originally would have been a total ban on the kratom, but he walked that back. They ended up in a place where it's going to ban these concentrated forms, and the other products can be sold in can't be sold in gas stations anymore, and you've got to be 21 now to buy them after this bill takes effect. They are allowing what they call whole leaf, which is sort of the un it's not synthetics, it's not concentrates. Those are going to be off the table. It's beginning in March of 2027, so there's a year sort of a runway for those companies to either start making something else or close up shop.
All right, so that's that is passed. We'll see if
It
the
is passed. It's on the governor's desk, so.
Yeah, okay. I want to move to Prop 4, just a brief update here. So they appear to have got the signatures needed. Does it look like they have a margin sufficient to withstand signature removals?
Yeah, I just looked at the update today. They're at about 166,000 signatures, which is more than they need statewide. It was looking really interesting on whether they were going to have a sustainable margin in some of the Senate districts, particularly in Davis County. But on Tuesday, I believe, of this week, the Davis County clerk realized there had been some packets that they had originally disqualified because they were not filed in a timely manner. And on second review, they realized they were misdated, and so they were timely. They added those to the totals, and the margins went from like 47 signatures in one case up to like 700 signatures. So they've got sizable cushions in most of the districts. The closest one, I think, right now they have a cushion of about 550 signatures, something like that. So even though there's this withdrawal period, you know, where people can remove their signatures, that's a pretty safe margin, and I think it looks reasonable. We can be reasonably certain that the repeal of Prop 4 will be on the ballot in November, which means over the next coming months, you'll probably be bombarded with ads from both sides telling you to vote for the repeal or against the repeal, and we'll find out in November how that plays out. I guess I should note that if the repeal does go through in the November ballot, it doesn't have any impact on the 2026 congressional election. It would just allow the legislature going forward to redraw the boundaries without the restrictions, the ban on gerrymandering that was put in place via the 2018 Better Boundaries Initiative. So, still fairly high stakes for the Republicans in particular, who are still upset that they're losing one of the four safe Senate district or safe, sorry, safe congressional districts that they had, and looking to get that back.
We're talking with politics reporter Robert Gerke on Behind the Headlines. Let's move to this story. Legislature rushes to amend Utah's new constitutional court to ward off legal challenges, so that Utah has a new constitutional court, right? This was passed, but already lawsuits, and so the legislature's trying to head those off, I guess.
Right, exactly. So this is more fallout from the redistricting fight, and some other court rulings that had not gone the legislature's way. They felt like what they wanted was, instead of just having one district judge with the power to, enjoin, block legislative enactments, they want to have three judges look at that. And there was some back and forth about how to do that. The argument is, from their perspective, is that more eyes on these things is better. Instead of just having one who can do it, let's have at least two of the three that could do it, and then it would go up to the Supreme Court after that. But so they wanted to create this three-judge panel. The way they ended up doing it, after some back and forth, was to have these three judges randomly assigned from the pool of sitting judges. And then cases that were already pending or filed against the state could be moved to be heard by this panel. And shortly after it was signed into law, Attorney General Derrick Brown had the first four cases moved to the panel. One was on Utah's abortion ban, one was on redistricting, one was challenging the state's action or inaction to save the Great Salt Lake, and one was challenging the state's reliance on fossil fuels brought by a number of young people who thought it was jeopardizing the environment. So the attorney general moved to have those four cases redirected or reassigned to these three-judge panels. The panels were assigned. And the plaintiffs in each of those lawsuits appealed to the Utah Supreme Court and said this entire three-judge panel is unconstitutional for a number of reasons, but one of the main ones was that only the state can move cases to the three-judge panel, and the plaintiffs did not have that luxury or that ability to do that. And Utah has in its constitution a guarantee to open access to courts, and they said that provides unequal access, advantages the government, disadvantages the average citizens. And so they've appealed that to the Utah Supreme Court and want it struck down. The legislature's responded already by saying, okay, we'll change it so either party can move these cases to the three-judge panel. And if the Utah Supreme Court says that the setup that we have is unconstitutional, we'll go back to what it was originally proposed, is a permanent set of three judges who would hear constitutional challenges in the state. Now, that got some criticism when it was initially proposed, because if the state is always going to be a party to these cases, and the state is responsible for appointing and confirming the three judges who are going to hear these cases, critics said that's, you get to pick your own referees, basically. And so we'll see how that goes. It's passed. It's going to the governor. So it has, again, both either party can now file, will now be able to file in these lawsuits. And if there's this what they call a trigger law, that if it is struck down, then this other thing takes effect, and that could also be challenged as well. But that's down the road a ways, obviously.
Politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, do you have time to talk about one more story? I want to talk about this interesting the world we live in. Here's the headline: The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints backed AI bill would make it easier to sue over damaging deep fakes. This is, of course, interesting because of the AI connection. Interesting as well because the church has weighed in on this. This is I think Senator Cullimore, what would this bill do?
Yeah, this was an interesting bill because when he brought it up, it was kind of this kind of arcane, nuanced approach to this. Right now, if somebody creates a deep fake or creates AI generated images that cause you financial harm, or if they are used for commercial purposes, you can sue them for slander, libel, defamation. What this, but sometimes showing that there you suffered economic harm is difficult, and sometimes they're not used for commercial purposes. And I couldn't figure out exactly what was behind this bill, but a large portion of it was that the LDS Church was concerned about, somebody could create a deep fake of a church leader saying something that damages the church, harms the church's reputation. It's hard for them to show that it caused them financial harm or that it was used in commercial purposes. But this bill would let them demand that it be taken down within 10 days. And if it's not, they could file a lawsuit over the harm that's done to their reputational harm by the use of those individuals' likenesses. And so this is a bill that got very little opposition. I mean, almost no opposition. In fact, I don't think anybody voted against it. Passed through and is going to the governor's desk. The church said that they are were aware of the bill, that they support the bill because it does provide some protections against bad actors who might be looking to embarrass or harm the church's reputation. And as Senator Cullimore said, it could be something as simple as maybe your neighbor puts something up that you don't that you think is damaging your reputation. It's not causing you economic harm. It's not used for commercial purposes, but you want it taken down. It just provides an avenue for you to do that.
This would have exceptions for what? News coverage, documentary films, that kind of thing.
Sort of First Amendment carve outs, right? So things like legitimate news stories, if you're making a documentary, if you're doing like a play that has, features somebody that, that might not have consented to that. If a parody or a satire, things like that, political speech. So these sort of First Amendment carve outs. It also you it provides, we all have a would under this law, assuming it takes effect, which I think it will, have a right, an exclusive right to our individual likeness, basically. And so you then, it extends 70 years past your death, and also people who died in the last 70 years would be covered under this as well. So, and it would go to, after you pass, it would obviously be your estate or your executors, your descendants, who would have the right to protect the use of your image, in the case that it's used in artificial intelligence generated deepfake.
So you said there nobody in the legislature voted against this. Was anybody speaking out against this bill?
There was a little bit of criticism that it might impede or infringe on some First Amendment rights, that speech that is not necessary. It does create a little bit of a gray area, like what is reputational harm? And there were people, there was a person from the Libertas Institute who said that this could have a chilling effect on free speech because, parties could. Who are litigious, I guess, could go to court and try to, threaten people with lawsuits for things that would otherwise be considered free speech. But it didn't obviously sway many people because it passed easily, and I would anticipate, I'm almost certain that the governor will sign it.
Well, we've been talking on Behind the Headlines with Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Have a great weekend.
Have a great weekend. Yeah, thanks. We need to let you go here so you can do reporting, I guess, on this busy last
Last
day of the legislature.
day of the session. I'm going to have a great weekend. So,
Okay. Busy weekend. Yeah, thank
all
you.
right. Yeah, we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Robert. Appreciate it. You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. We're going to take a break. When we come back, a couple of headlines to talk about. A man accused in Wayne County killings faces aggravated murder charges. And UDOT wants to build a highway through generations-old agricultural land. Farmers and activists are pushing back. We'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Sam Moylan following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. In this part of the program, we bring in Salt Lake Tribune reporter Sam Moylan. Sam, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Well, talk about a couple of stories. We'll get to growth in Heber Valley and a proposed highway there that has some people really in opposition. But we want to start with killings in Wayne County. Here's the headline: man accused in Wayne County killings faces aggravated murder charges. You've been covering this story. This apparently is a man from Iowa. Do we know why he was in Wayne County?
Yeah, so we actually don't know why he was in Wayne County or Utah at all. So authorities just released the charging documents in court records, and they have the three homicide charges, but they don't say exactly why he was here. We're not sure if they don't know or, you know, if that just wasn't released yet, but we're still trying to look for some more information.
We know his name now, Ivan Miller. He faces three counts, each first degree felonies of aggravated murder. So he's charged with killing three women. Tell us briefly what we know that happened there.
So what we know so far is one of the women, and this is where investigators say he started with her death. The woman was in her 80s and she lived in Lyman, and Miller allegedly killed her at her home. All that investigators seem to know is that he wanted her car. He had run into an elk earlier with his truck. So we're assuming that they may have totaled the vehicle, but for some reason he was in need of another car. So he went to this woman's home and he killed her. And he took her Buick, and that is when he then drove the Buick to a trailhead, which is about 15 miles away, near State Route 12. And that is where he saw the other two victims. It was two women. We know one was in her 30s and the other was in her 60s. And he saw them and decided that he wanted their vehicle. The women were getting out of a white Subaru. So he killed those two women as well at that trailhead and took their Subaru. And he fled across multiple states. The search went through northern Arizona. It went through parts of New Mexico. And he was eventually found in Colorado. And he had abandoned the Subaru.
How was he found? What were the factors there?
Authorities were able to track the vehicle. So first they traced where the Buick had been, and it was eventually found abandoned at the trailhead where he allegedly killed the two women. And then with one of the women's that was killed at the trailhead, one of their husbands, he was able through an app to track the Subaru that Miller allegedly took. And through that app, they were able to place it in New Mexico, and then they were able to place it in parts of Colorado. And when they found that the vehicle was abandoned in Colorado, authorities were able to track down Miller pretty close nearby.
What was the response in the meantime? And again, this is very recent. It happened, Wednesday of this week, I believe, right?
Yeah.
Then he was this man was captured on Thursday of this week. So I believe you're reporting that Wayne County School District closed schools, they say, out of an abundance of caution.
Yeah, and they did post that on their Facebook account, and they posted that Wednesday night. There was a bunch of alerts going out in the community. People were posting that, you know, they were told to stay at home, and, you know, people didn't know what was going on. It was three deaths, and you know, they didn't know if there would be more, if this was like an active shooter or these were targeted. So people just out of precaution, a lot of offices closed, the school district closed. And we have not heard back from the school district on whether they're going to reopen now that after the suspect was apprehended. But yeah, we were told that this was just something that a lot of, you know, offices and businesses did across the community when they were hearing about the news, just to be safe.
And in the meantime, there was a time, you know, the alleged shooter was on the loose. So I think law enforcement in I'm reading here, Sevier, San Juan, Grand, Emery counties, they all posted warnings. You never know what's going to happen.
Exactly.
So I think you're going to be doing some more reporting. You'll be talking to some more people there in Wayne County in the aftermath of this tragedy. What are officials in Wayne County or some of the towns they're saying?
We haven't talked to officials in Wayne County yet. That is, a next step for us. But a lot of all the information that we have been getting has come through state officials at this point. But we are heading down there because we are trying to get a better sense of, how the community is mourning these women and who they were in their towns too. Where did they go to church? Where did they shop? And who were their loved ones and their friends? So, at this point, authorities have not released the victims' names as they're notifying the family and giving them, some time to contact their loved ones first. But in the meantime, we are visiting the town just to talk with people and see how they are coping with this tragedy.
Well, you can find all of that coverage, including the future coverage, at sltrib.com, sltrib.com. We're talking with reporter Sam Moylanen. Let's turn to another story. This is a story about growth, essentially. Here's the headline: UDOT wants to build a highway through generations-old agricultural land. Farmers and activists are pushing back. We're talking about Heber Valley here. So I guess, first of all, before we get into the details here, they had many people had a protest. A tractorcade was what they called it.
Yeah, have you ever heard of a
I
tractorcade?
haven't heard of a tractorcade, no. I guess tractors must be involved, right? And I see the photos here. They were you're
Was
going
my first time too. Apparently it was a popular protest tactic in like the late 1970s when farmers would go out and they would take their tractors and they would protest on the tractors kind of backstopping, traffic, and it would kind of create a little bit of an inconvenience, but it was a way for them to protest the commodity prices and other issues at that time. So residents and farmers and landowners in Heber Valley came out last Saturday using the same tactic, a little bit of a modernized version. We had the tractors kind of carrying the front of the line, but in the back, a lot of people also followed in their cars too, for the modern day mode of transportation. So yeah, it was really cool to see.
What were some of the signs they were holding up? What was the sentiment?
I mean, one of them, one woman held a sign, "Your shortcut is our shortfall." That is because this tractorcade was to protest a plan by our Department of Transportation. Basically, they want to build a bypass to go off Route 40 that will cut through Heber Valley's North Fields, which is this stretch of mostly farmland and wetlands, sort of close to the Wasatch Back. And they're recommending this route because it's apparently it will impact less residential homes, it'll impact less businesses. But the people that came out to protest think that, this is going to damage their farmland indefinitely and also maybe cause some water issues as well. So that's kind of the reasoning behind that sign. There was a couple other interesting ones as well. One said "cows over diesel" and "save the North Fields." Another one was "stop selling out our valley." And the Heber City Mayor Heidi Franco came out and her sign said "protect farms, not diesels," and she was ringing a cowbell out of her car window.
So U.S. Highway 40 winds its way through downtown Heber City. I've driven that highway many, many times. And I guess UDOT is worried that we can kind of skip to the end of the story and then loop back. What are they saying? That they say they have a prediction by 2050 this will be totally clogged if they don't do something.
That's exactly it. So Route 40 goes right through Heber's main street, and there's no other way around it. UDOT is saying that this is going to get extremely backed up and cause a lot of traffic issues. But what was interesting is I thought was at what I was asking, residents if traffic is a concern for them. Like, are they interested in having a bypass so that these big trucks aren't going through their downtown? And some of them said that they didn't care, they didn't mind at all because it preserved the land around it from potentially being impacted. And others were saying that they just want UDOT to consider an alternative option. They did test or kind of look at in their environmental study another route, but like I mentioned before, they decided not to go with that one because it would go through more homes and more businesses.
Some of the main objections, you've talked about this, but you kind of outlay it in more detail in your story, the price tag, the farms, agricultural area, and the water. Let's take these one at a time. So the price tag, it's set to be pretty expensive, I think.
So both of the routes that UDOT looked at were going to be over 700 million. So that made some of the protest organizers were calling it the $1 billion bypass, even though it's a little bit shy of that. Some of the residents in the area are very concerned about how that bypass is going to be funded.
Because some of the protesters say they want, at least they want a clear picture of all costs before they, before it's green lit.
Yes, exactly. And at this point, there wasn't, UDOT didn't seem to have a clear picture from any documentation that I read about how they were going to fund this bypass at this point.
So let's talk about the agricultural nature of this area. Some of the protesters were saying a bypass would cut in two some of these farms and would make that land, I guess, less valuable for farming.
That was a major concern for a lot of people. The tractorcade actually drove through most of it with the protesters, and it went right through this agricultural land. And just as they said, it's all farmland. It is some wetland, and they're worried that it's going to, some residents said that maybe it'll pave the way for more development. Another issue is that, how will they be able to farm with all of these trucks and cars driving right through their land? That was a big concern. How are they going to get, their livestock and their animals from, one part of the farm to the next? Do they have to cross this road, or, how is it? I guess it seemed like a lot of people were very concerned because they didn't have a clear picture of how this may affect their property, their land, and also their views that they've treasured for so long that they really don't want to change.
Several people you quote saying that, right? That's unimpeded views. It's a kind of a rural area, but that would this would potentially change the nature of the valley.
That was a primary concern for a lot of them. And there was one woman too that was walking around the protests, and she had these cards. This was before the tractor procession set off, and she had these cards with like these pictures of the valley and the wildflowers growing on the north fields, and just for people to sign or send to others. It's kind of asking people to care about this valley. One of the things some of the organizers of the protest talked about was that it's not just us that live right here in Heber that are impacted, but anyone that cares about this valley and cares about preserving its beauty, could also, speak to this bypass. Right now, people have until March 9th to share any of their opinions or views about the bypass, with UDOT.
Tell me about water concerns. Several people brought this up.
Yeah, so the North Fields sit right on top of an aquifer. And that was water concerns were a pretty big one because people are worried that apparently it's a very shallow aquifer that's been around for a long time. A lot of people get their drinking water through there, and they're worried that if they build this highway over this land, pollutants and like runoff could get into this aquifer and affect their drinking water.
So UDOT, I'm sure, is saying they're going to mitigate some of these concerns. What are they saying? How are they going to address some of these concerns?
They said that they wasn't immediately clear exactly how, but they're going to do some like mitigation strategies. Like we're like mitigating the runoff, erosion control, like managing storm, like the stormwater runoff, and do different things to prevent contaminants from reaching the aquifer.
So how do people comment? They have till March 9th. How do you comment?
You can go. There's a website that I link to in the story that has this Heber Valley Corridor project, and it has all of the updated information that UDOT has put out. There's a ton of documents on there, and they can also go through there and fill out their comment.
Okay, yeah, go to the story, sltrib.com. There's a link there to comment if you would like. Well, interesting story, Heber Valley there. And we've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Sam Moylan, and thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. And thanks for listening today. Hope you join me for Behind the Headlines again next time.